Welcome to the History of Networking, where we drag all of the skeletons out of the wiring closet and ponder the ghosts of protocols past.
Hello, Donald.
How's it going?
You have a blank background right now. I don't know if I can handle that.
Yeah, my wife decided she wants to move things around.
And today, joining us from Boulder, Colorado, we have John Chapman with a picture of the backside of Hawaii, one of the islands, and I don't remember which one it is now, behind him. Kauai. There you go. Awesome. So welcome, John, to the History of Networking.
Hi, Russ. Hi, Don. Thanks for having me on your show.
So, John, why don't we start with just a background of where you came from, how you came into the networking industry, and then we'll move into DOCSIS cable modems. Whatever we talk about is cool.
That sounds good. DOCSIS is a story close to my heart. I got into networking back in the 80s when I graduated. The IBM PC had just come out. My brother and I invented our own local area network we called CLAN 2. It was for Chapman's local area network, although we got funding from the government. So we told them it was Canadian local area network. We just changed the C for whoever would give us money. And the 2 was for voice and data. So we actually built these local area network devices that hooked IBM PCs together. And we were sitting there going, there's got to be something that hooks LANs together. Something like, which eventually would have been a router, would have been our next thing. But then I got whisked off with a job offer to Silicon Valley and the promise that PBXs were going to rule the world of networking, and went off for 5 years and did voice systems for Europe, which is a lot of fun. And then I joined a little startup in Silicon Valley called Cisco. It was 20 engineers when I joined them. They're just in their first set of buildings moving out of a garage. I got hired in by the founders, Len and Sandy. It was back when they were a private company. Very exciting times, very intense times. There's probably lots of stories we could go through from the early days of Cisco. But from there, my first project actually was to take the internet, which was running at 1.5 megabits per second. The whole internet was built out of T1 lines. My job was to move it up to DS3 lines. So I ended up building the serial interface I called HSSI, high-speed serial interface. And that hooked in. I got a buddy of mine who was interested in the startup. He did an adapter into DS3. And within about a year or two, the whole backbone of the internet was maybe a bit longer, a year or two, a couple of years. The whole backbone of the internet went up to 45 megabits per second. This is all pre-Sonnet days. All NSF was all running off of HSSI. I did the first ASIC at Cisco to drive HSSI. It was a serial chip. So we called it Muselux. Just a bit of trivia there. And that was back in 1.2, I think, which would be 1200 nanometer. And just as reference, ASICs today are done in 7 nanometers. So that's how much the technology has come in the last few years.
So what kind of protocol was that running? Was that PPP?
HDLC. Yeah, just good old HDLC, bit stuffing. And it was, in order to get logic, that it was running at 45 megabits per second. And the logic of the day, F logic, only ran at about 10 megahertz. So I used ECL, something probably people, doesn't even exist anymore these days, but it was emitter coupled logic. I used ECL and got something running at 45 megabits per second.
The first overclocking.
Yeah, but if you know anything about serial links, one of the cool things that I include in there is I made the interface could do DTE or DCE. And what that allowed is 2 AGS pluses to get connected, hooked together with a 50 megabit per second serial cable. And so a whole bunch of our deployments were just hooking 2 CMTSs together, actually.
And so that is the origin of the 60-pin cable.
When I'm looking for that hissy cable, I had to pick a cable. So I ended up picking this cable, and then the SCSI connect people pick the same cable. And then subsequent to hissy, I did a universal serial interface at Cisco, and that was a 60-pin cable. That's probably the one you're thinking about. And that was a universal serial cable that did, I call it the 5-in-1. So it did 5 different serial interfaces, DTE and DCE. So it was one connector pinning out to 10 different connectors. And then I did a serial ASIC, or had a serial ASIC done for me in analog, that locked it down to like 17 pins and upped it to 12 serial interfaces. We had, one connector and 12 serial interfaces on cables. It completely simplified the whole serial interfaces. It was actually a lot of fun. I can remember a story where I was all done this and I shipped it they told me it's broken in the field. I was interfacing into some adapter that went to T1 or something like this. And they told me it wasn't working and they line stopped it. I went in and analyzed that piece of equipment had their clock upside down. So we were fully compliant. Their clock was upside down and broken. And then the order was like, yeah, but their stuff's in the field and yours isn't. So go make it work. And so it's like I had to redesign it to detect the clock phase and automatically just flip the clock. And it was a real lesson to me that you have to design for backwards compatibility, even if it's right or wrong. The upside is I never got another call on that box again. It just auto flipped and it worked no matter what you did to it. So it was like one of those good lessons that specifications don't always rule the day.
Yeah, I remember taking the CCIE lab. They would actually push the pins back on the 60-pin cable so it wouldn't quite connect.
Really?
And you couldn't visually see. Because all the pins, there's the pin density is so high on that cable that you couldn't actually see which one was pushed back. They just push it back a quarter of an inch or something, and it wouldn't make connection.
Oh, you mean to test you guys?
Yeah, exactly. Oh. As a troubleshooting.
Yeah, that's funny. I hadn't heard that story.
So you got this rack, and there's this big pile of 60-pin cables laying around there, and you're like, you pick a 60-pin cable to connect these two AGSs together, and it won't work. And you're like, what is going on? That is HSSI, right?
Well, there was HSSI was the 50 megabit per second serial link. I was the ECL1, and then I did a universal serial, which was like, you'll probably remember the V.35, RS-449, RS-550, there was a 232 in there. There was one or two other things that were kicking around there. So that was a universal serial. We ended up using that really for hooking into T1 adapters and DS3 adapters and things like that. That was the whole genesis behind the wide area networking, really. And it was that wide area networking. Oh, I did basic grid. I did a basic grid router one time with a serial interface on it for the heck of it. Thinking we all thought the ISDN market was going to take off. And it turns out it was a serial market that took off. ISDN never really took off.
How did frame relay fit into that? Did you have to do special stuff for frame relay, or is that all? That was all 60-pin as well, wasn't it?
Frame relay would be a protocol that went over top of serial. There was SMDS, frame relay, there was a bunch of them, and they're all about adapting T1 rates. And it's trying to give the telco something to be able to offer in some way of managing data over a T1. So all of that went into an external data services unit, a DSU, and then that hooked into serial. So we would always get the packet extraction. Frame relay protocol would be run. The hardware would be run separate. We actually ran frame relay software inside the router to set up the connections.
The whole subinterface concept came about because of frame ATM, that type of stuff, software IDVs and stuff like that that came into play.
Yeah, that would have been back in the day of 20 protocols. I don't remember Cisco was, their big claim to fame was we can route 20 different, interconnect 20 different protocols.
Yeah, well, we were still routing AppleTalk and IPX. In fact, when I was in Cisco TAC, I was on the routing protocols team, and they would send us IPX cases. We were like, why are you sending us IPX cases? And they're like, because extra stands for extended, right? So IP, so it's IP, it's just extended IP. We're like, no. If you put anything after the IP, it's not our case.
The team actually built an AppleTalk board for the AGS Plus, although I think it got killed off before the SCSD.
Okay, cool. So talk to us about DOCSIS, the foundation of the cable business unit there at Cisco, and how that came to be. I think it's really interesting because we talk a lot about comm servers, and a lot of people today don't even know what a comm server is. They've never worked on one. They don't remember all the old stacks of entire racks of cable modems plugged into, whatever it was. And so it's kind of interesting to see how we move from that world into the world we're in today, where we mostly have optics and cable modems. Cable modems are a big thing.
Cable modems are a huge thing. I would say the cable industry really revolutionized broadband, because going to your house, there was only twisted pair for telephony and coax for video. And both of those industries tried to adapt to some type of internet access. And if you remember back in the days of the 60-pin connector, we all connected to the internet over dial-up. I remember when modems went from 9600 baud to 14.4 to 19.2. And then there was a 56K modem on the horizon. And that was pretty exciting. Well, we went you know, I had done a bunch of router products, and myself and a few of the early founders at Cisco wanted to go do something different. And we looked at different industries to get into. It was my idea to get into cable. And Carson Chen and I co-founded the Cable BU back in 1996 as an internal startup at Cisco. Now, we didn't know it at the time, but it turns out that Cable BU was going to become the only startup at Cisco in a market adjacency, so something that wasn't a router, that didn't get killed off and replaced by a spin, M&A acquisition, and actually got to $1 billion of business and survived. We've survived at this point in time for 24 years, I think we've been up. So 1996 to 2000. An internal startup. And I've actually, as a founder, I've stuck with it for 24 years. Usually they kick founders out, I think, in startups. It's supposed to be some kind of unwritten rule. But anyway, we wanted to get in the cable industry. And at the time, it was a bunch of proprietary modems out there. There was companies like Zenith had a system, and Motorola had a system. Land City had just put together a system that they were trying where they had put Ethernet on cable. And it was back in the old style Ethernet where everybody would just broadcast. So it was a collision, you'd rebroadcast again. So when it got busy, the whole thing would just melt down. And then these modems, which are really, really hot, which would melt anything that was close to them. But they did get things started. And we started off with a proprietary system. Our team came out of the 7500, if you remember the 7500. We ended up extending that. I killed that project, and we decided to baseline off the 7200, which is a smaller router and had more flexibility.
And actually faster.
Was it faster, you think?
It was faster at process switching. It was not fast because you didn't have the SSC, right? But the rate at which it could process switch packets was actually much, much faster. So we used to use it as a crypto box.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have hardware crypto, but you did have a faster processor on the 7200, so you could actually push a lot more crypto through a 72.
Yeah, it was a nice spot for your listeners. The way the genealogy of Cisco went is we did this AGS Plus, which is this dedicated machine of horizontal micro-coded processors, and that became the 7000, which then became the 7500. And so it was all custom hardware. The 7200 just used the CPU. It was a lower-end box, and there was animosity between the 7500 and 7200 people because it was so different. 7200 is a great software router. And our team descended out of the 7500 team. And I ended up cutting the whole team over to the 7200, much to their discussed, but it turns out we really needed a software-based router to get the complicated router protocols that we did. Anyway, we did an interesting investment. We needed a chipset for cable modems, and so we hunted around. We found this small, you know, we were a startup company. Well, I guess we were a startup company more. We invested in this other startup company that you might have heard of called Broadcom. They were doing set-top box silicon, and they wanted to get into the cable modem business, and we wanted to get in the cable modem business. We made a deal. We invested $3 million in them, put together a joint development team that I ran, and they ended up building ASIC hardware, and we ended up testing that hardware in our labs on FPGAs. We tested the Verilog code on FPGAs. And as a result, and then right when we started all that work, the cable industry kind of got interested in doing something. And so rather than having proprietary modems, they put together a consortium called MCNS to go work on something which later became DOCSIS. DOCSIS stands for Data Over Cable System Interface Specifications. It's a very weird name, but it's basically Ethernet on top of coax with a scheduled upstream. And so so we contributed our intellectual property jointly between Cisco and Broadcom into this consortium. And Broadcom ended up going in as a representative chip vendor. Tom Quigley was the fellow I was working with at the time. Brilliant man. A lot of brilliant people actually in cable. And the very first DOCSIS spec came out in 1996 at the Western Cable Show was announced. We had a Western Cable Show. And so we contributed to that spec. We hadn't quite seen the spec yet, what they were in. And the big thing is they really ended up going towards packets. There was all this, should we do ATM? Should we do some kind of TDM system? And they really decided to hunker down and really focus on Ethernet and do packets, which is revolutionary back in the day, believe it or not. And so we immediately cut over, started working on a DOCSIS product. 9 months later, we shipped our first product. And the way we did it, because we shipped an empty chassis. And we said, anybody who buys an empty chassis is the first people to get the first line card in the industry. And the line cards, because we were debugging the Broadcom ASIC code on FPGAs, we actually built an FPGA line card and shipped it. So we had a one down, one up line card. So one RF port down, one RF port up, because in cable, you have separate RF for downlink and uplink, downstream and upstream. We shipped that card, and the irony is by the next Christmas, everybody who had all the customers who had worked on DOCSIS and supported it for years were too paranoid to actually put it in the field, because they saw all the challenges. You know, when you're in development, you sometimes get skeptical in your own product. And so the next Western Cable Show comes along, and TCI, none of those guys would actually buy the equipment. Cogeco, this company out of Canada, comes in and deploys 2,000 cable modems by Christmas. They hadn't been involved in the spec, but they'd heard of it, and they thought, this is great. We can make some money. They buy our system, deploy a couple of thousand cable modems. They're the first cable operator to actually have deployed DOCSIS by 1997, the Western Cable Show in the fall of 1997. And then the ice was broken, and off it went. And we ended up going, we did a one-by-one card, and then we had to roll the FPGAs a few times, and we finally got ASICs, and we had to roll. It was until the third generation of ASICs that things finally worked. So we were on our fourth or fifth line card before something, whole protocol worked. And we ended up with a one down, six up line card we called the 1x6. Our CMTS at the time was called 7246. UBR 7246 had four cards and six slots.
Which is we're still a 7200 chassis. Right?
We rebuilt the chassis because we had RF in the box. So the top part was the CPUs from the 7200. And then we had kind of like this big RF barrier. And then the bottom part, we had all the RF. And we had guys that told us it would never work. You couldn't put digital and RF in the same box. It'll never work. Well, we made it work. And if you think, it's pretty challenging, actually, because the RF can leak back in and cause all sorts of noise, and the digital can cause all sorts of corruption of the RF. So it was quite the intense EMI design of the day. That was a pretty heavy box.
Were you pushing both RF and the Ethernet off the same side of the router, or did you actually reverse them so like the Ethernet was out one side and the RF was out the other side? How did you work that?
We had the Ethernet come out. The top of the box was your classic router, so Ethernet and CPUs kind of on the top part, and then this RF type of line, and then the bottom part was all the RF. But it was a common backplane that hooked it up, and that was the concern. We had PCI. The PCI 7200 is built on the PCI bus.
Three PCI buses, two and a half.
So we had line cards hooked to PCI bus, PCI 1.0 to RF, and that had to have a solid ground plane. And the engineers were really, really worried about the transference of noise across that ground plane. But we made it all work. We shipped DOCSIS out into the field, and it just took off. And, you know, in the beginning, they had the HFC plant. For your listeners, I should probably tell what an HFC plant is. You get coax coming into your house, but how does it get there? So in the cable company, they would have a head end where all the video equipment is, and then closer to the neighborhood, a hub site, which had transmission equipment. And so a hub site might service, let's say, 20,000 homes. They used to come out of that hub site with coax and just interconnect everybody, and you'd run the signal down the coax, and you'd tap it off or power split it to each house. When you ran out of power, you'd add an amplifier and then do it all over again and add an amplifier and do it all over again. So you could measure the size of your plant by how many amplifiers you had in any one direction. And because you're splitting, it's a two-dimensional problem. So the old systems might have 30 amplifiers in one direction. And from an area-wise, you know, maybe 100 amplifiers. Those had no return path, but you could get video through them. So in the 1990s, they ran fiber to the neighborhoods, and they broke up the coax plant into maybe 1,000 or 2,000 homes passed per coax segment. So you run fiber to the neighborhood, convert to coax, and go coax to the home. And that fiber was an analog fiber. They actually took the RF frequency range, which would be 54 to, let's say, it was 750 at the time, or 550 megahertz. Now it's 1.2 gig. They would modulate a lambda. So just think of taking your frequency spectrum for TV, upconverting it to a lambda, which is a wavelength. And then when it hit the node, you would downconvert it. And the brilliance of that, there was no digitization whatsoever.
So this is prior to actually running wave deflection, wave duplexing, right?
WDM.
Yeah,
wave duplexing multiplexing. This is prior to Sonnet. I don't know if you, back, we were talking about HISI, right? HISI, HSSI connected into DS3, which eventually connected to Sonnet. And so OC1 was coming out in those days, which is 50 megabits per second. This technology, this analog technology, was the equivalent of 5 gigabits per second. Back in a day when the telcos were running at 50 megabits per second. So that is like 100x faster in terms of information that was being brought across the cable. And it's lasted to this day. The whole plant is still built like that. We're in the process of replacing it with a remote PHY technology, which actually converts something Cisco, something I invented over at Cisco, and it converts the fiber to 10 gigabit per second. So that analog has persisted to this day. It's incredible. And meanwhile, digital technology went from 50 megabit to 10 gigabit, and now we're cutting over. So anyway, what we did with DOCSIS is we basically took a TV channel space, an analog TV channel, put a QAM carrier in there and put bits on top of the QAM carrier. And we got like a 27 megabit per second downstream. And then the upstream, the only way to make an upstream work was to rebuild that plant to something like a node plus 5 amplifiers, which you call N plus 5. And with maybe only 1,000 homes in there, you could get the upstream clean enough. And so they would make the upstream clean enough to actually get a carrier through it. They had gotten QPSK carriers through for set-top boxes, but now they needed to get something like a QPS carrier through for a cable modem. So the biggest effort in the plant was really cleaning up the noise. Most of the noise is from hair dryers and washing machines and dryers in the homes that were leaking in. So they had to stop all the home noise from leaking into the plant. But they did it. They got the cable plant into a two-way plant, which we were then able to lay carriers on top of to create a DOCSIS network to bring broadband to your home. And originally, the upstream was so crappy that we considered using a telco return, dial-up. So you'd come over the plant and use dial-up modems in the return path. And that was all spec'd out. It could have worked, but economically, that means that the cable companies would have had to pay their competitors for the return path, which just was not going to fly in the real world. So that got killed off, and they invested money on improving the plant. But yeah, we got it off, and then it was, you know, back in the early days, it was a big DOCSIS versus DSL market for 10 years. Who's faster? And DSL went through ADSL and all sorts of different ranges, and we started cranking up our DOCSIS versions. Cable eventually won. We now supply most of the broadband in the world, in the United States. Well, a lot of the world's connecting to fiber now, but prior to any fiber of the home being there, DOCSIS really became king of broadband.
Why did cable win?
It won because it was in an interesting spot between two points. We were competing against twisted pair, so we had a better medium, coax versus twisted pair. So, you know, you throw science and physics at it, and we were able to get more bandwidth out of coax over time as ASIC density provided to us. And then the other bracket was really fiber. You know, fiber's got a lot of bandwidth to it, but it costs a lot of money to deploy fiber to the home. So when twisted pair ran out of gas, you didn't have fiber, there was this huge sweet spot, which was HFC in the middle. So that's really how it happened. And it turns out we've gotten a very good competitive service going. Like today, we have a couple of gigabit sitting on your local plant. That neighborhood that was 27 megabits per second shared amongst, you know, a couple hundred cable modems is now a couple of gigabit shared amongst a couple hundred cable modems. And we actually, I can kind of run you through the history, but we have a lot more growth we can do in cable. We could actually increase capacity by another 100x from where we're at right now. We're really just waiting for the market demand.
And for more cable deployment, right? Middle mile cable deployment's really the problem, it seems to me. Because you can't carry the QAM over coax for that long of a distance, right? What is your distance limitation?
We designed DOCSIS to work on a 100-mile plant. And out of that 100-mile, fiber will be most of that plant, and the coax will be the last mile or so. Last mile coax for, you know, and then everything else is fiber. And we do QAM over fiber because of the analog fiber. So you're right. There is a distance limitation on that QAM, be it whether you're a lambda or your coax, it's really the same modulation. But we have it working great at 100 miles. But now what we're doing with the Remote PHY technology is we're putting the QAM and OFDM modulators out in the node. So out, you know, 99 miles out, so you have a mile of coax, we put it out there. So you don't have any of the degradation from the fiber and you have a nice small local loop. In which case we'll get incredible scaling out of it.
So when you're using QAM, I mean, a lot of listeners may not know that this is really what we're talking about here is something that originated in the wireless world, right?
You know, it probably goes back to military. I can't remember where it came from. We end up using it, you know, the QAM. Actually, one of the guys, we bought a company called Scientific Atlanta years ago. And I distinctly remember one of the engineers in Scientific Atlanta claiming that he invented the QAM modulation. And they licensed that out to Broadcom at the time, and which became the genesis of Broadcom's birth, actually, was the use of that QAM carrier. And so they actually, you know, the TV itself was analog over coax, and then they brought in the QAM carrier and did digital TV over coax. And then, you know, we inherited that QAM carrier, and I think the rest of the world inherited it. Back in the day, we were doing this. I'm not sure they had put QAM into wireless yet at that point in time. But, you know, it all these guys kind of work together, and it turns out we all kind of use the same technology, and it's all gated by physics and silicon capability. And all these QAM, you know, we did our QAM carrier, it would take a one rack unit. Like when NVIDIA was doing QAM, one RU, you could get one QAM out of it, right? It was all discreetly built with resistors and transistors. Now we have chips on them that give us 1,000 QAMs.
Well, you have to have four different transmitters effectively, or more than four, depending on how many parallel modulation streams you're trying to stick onto the single cable. And each of those is actually an RF transmitter. And back in the day, you couldn't get RF on a chip. So it was just, you had to have a tube or a transistor or a specialized.
I mean, the secret of our industry and the mobile industry is that our entire growth has been predicated by the rise of the ASICs. Like we were actually sitting there waiting for a QAM on a chip. And we were plotting like when we can put a QAM on an ASIC, here's how dense we can make our box. You know, that 7246 had four down, four up on it to start with, all discrete logic and stuff like that. And then eventually we had a 1x6 card and then a 2x8 card. And then we got to our second generation CMTSs. And again, we had discrete QAMs. Now eventually you could end up generating, because one of the things you have to do is get to the spectrum. So they have a technique they call direct digital synthesis, where you use DSP to create the QAM, and you spit out to D to A converter, which means, and Broadcom was very good at putting D to A converters on chip. But it meant the chip had to work out to like a gigahertz. And it took a long time for silicon to kind of get there. But now, I mean, we were always waiting on the density of silicon and the density of RF. I would say us and the wireless industry in general, we've hit an inflection point within the last 5 years where it's reversed. We have so much capacity available in silicon that our limitations are other things. Actually, silicon's ahead of the market in this particular point at this point in time.
Okay. Yeah, I just remember back when I worked on radar systems and we had transmitters that were utterly huge physically with like a magnetron and, you know, a flywheel circuit that would push the push enough power into the magnetron or a thyrotron. We had a thyrotron on one box. And, you know, all of that, like even the VORs and TACANs have gone all solid state and all of that's in chips now. And that's just because you can now get not necessarily the power you need because you can shove a power amplifier off the back of the chip, but you get the modulation that you need in the chipset itself. And then you can push a class A or class B or an op amp or something behind that to get the power up once it's modulated. And the chips are such clean modulators that you can actually shove a class A or a class B behind them and you still get clean signal. Didn't used to be that way.
Not many people remember those days, Russ. That's pretty good memory. No, it's really amazing how things have gone. I mean, you know, to give you the date, we start off with DOCSIS 1.0. I should give you a quick rundown. In 1996, that got best effort data going. Then we did DOCSIS 1.1, where we added quality of service. That's where we put the voice in there. And that's also the time that AT&T thought it'd be a really good idea to get into cable. So they bought a plant, they bought a bunch of HFC plant from a company called TCI, which was founded by John Malone, who was the cable cowboy business guy behind all of cable as kind of we know it today. He's the guy who buys properties and sells them to somebody else. So actually, I remember working with the voice guys at AT&T to get voice onto cable. We just finished. This is a funny and interesting story. If you've worked on voice, if you remember ATM, because we had finished and gotten this packet system up and running, we were very proud of. And AT&T guys came by and said, "Well, you know, you have to redesign all that to do ATM, so we can put voice over cable." And we didn't want to do that, and they didn't want to use packets for voice because they knew voice over IP wouldn't work, which of course it eventually did. So the compromise, I drove a compromise with like five various team folks from Bell Labs, that if we took a packet, made it fixed length, and then sent it at a regular interval, so it looked like ATM, it performed the same as ATM, but it was really just a fixed length packet. Could we get away with that? We eventually agreed to go do that. And so I put in a special scheduling mechanism in Doxis to basically literally emulate ATM, but as a way of politically getting voice over IP into cable. And that works to this day. And of course, you know, when ATM disappeared off the scene a few years later. So it was a good thing we didn't kind of revert back to ATM.
That 8500 switch was a disaster.
Well, you know what? Where ATM, what killed off ATM? Believe it or not, we bought it. You know, at Cisco, we bought a company, we bought Stratacom to go to ATM to compete in the market. And ATM had all this vision of switching voice and all these dynamic switches. What it was really great for was just developing it. You could have dynamic nail up of circuits, permanent virtual circuits. So instead of having dedicated DS3s, you could put an ATM network in there and then change your long distance connections through the network. So you could change your permanent virtual circuits. None of the voice transfers really came along. It was just a great underlay network for the internet. And what killed it off, believe it or not, was just economics. It was like the next generation of, there was a next generation ATM switch, next generation router. And at some point in time, the cost per bit was so low on the routers, it didn't make sense to buy ATM switches anymore for our customers or for us to invest in it. It just aged out on its own. And I think the other truth of the matter is, you know, when we were a small company, we were focused on the enterprise market. And as the service provider market came into being, there wasn't any routers that could service a market at that scale. And so they latched onto ATM as a way of making cheap ASICs with the fixed length packet. And that ran for a good 10 or 15 years before the IP guys, the router guys, could really catch up to the scale required for service provider. And the ASIC density and things that were needed, and the reliability, HA, all that type of thing. So eventually, you know, IP had to grow into that market, really. And then it had it up. And I think that's been the story of IP in many, many places, by the way. It's had to grow into a lot of these markets. It had to grow into the cable market and in the mobile market as well. I mean, it's only now with 4G and 5G that we're really looking at all IP transports.
Yeah, so what would you do differently, looking back, about the cable industry now?
Well, isn't that a great question? I mean, I think that, you know, I'll take the moment to say, I think one of the things that I thought was really done right, and that was everybody got together in the cable industry and everybody was a pioneer, and we all got together and designed a DOCSIS specification together, standardized it, and then we all built products to it, and all the cable companies bought those products. And it was a wonderful formula because it created the market that everybody could compete in. And then it gave all one uniform product strategy to all the other vendors. And it was driven by the operators. When we did it, the vendors would write the specs and the operators would drive the requirements. It was a very well balanced market for pretty much the entire existence of the marketplace to this day. I don't know, I think we had a couple of missed starts on some technology along the way, but sometimes that's just the way it is. I actually really like the way that DOCSIS evolved. You know, I think today we've actually got too many choices and we're not quite too sure where to go. We've got so much bandwidth in the network, we really don't have to move that fast. I mean, we're a bit spoiled now by the choices, but I actually really do like the way that DOCSIS unfolded. I got a lot of people in other standards committees who were jealous of how quickly we could turn things around. I mean, we could write a spec in, you know, 3 or 4 months and have it published and have everybody designing to it with interoperability and the whole thing. I mean, to give you an example of cooperation, in DOCSIS 3.1, we introduced OFDM technology. And that was a radical shift, move away from QAM to an OFDM. And I put together a consortium with our two competitors, which at the time were Aris and Motorola. The three of us got together and we wrote a 150 white paper on why OFDM was better than QAM. So the three main CMTS vendors worked together, proved it out, and then sat down and wrote the spec. And then we all built products and competed against each other in the end. But it was a brilliant bit of cooperation between the vendors. I've just never really seen so much cooperation between vendors to go achieve a common goal and such a dedication of people to an industry. It's been something I've been very proud to be part of and something I've been very proud of the industry for what they've achieved. I'm not too sure I would touch that. I do think that, you know, another lesson walking away from that is when you have focus, you can accomplish a lot. We were all razor focused from 1.0 all the way up to 3.1 on what we were going to accomplish, and we accomplished a lot. So I think at times we lost focus. We did this SCDMA one thing for a 2.0, which took a lot of effort, never ended up shipping to the field. We're struggling with different options on which way to go in the plant these days with 4.0 and DAA. There's a few different options that we're sorting out as an industry, and that focus is slowing us down. But you get a lot of brilliant people in a room with clear focus, and it's amazing what you can accomplish. And the focus has to be customer driven. You know, we had guys who could invent the technology and customers who could say, well, if you can do this, this is what I can do with it. And then decision makers that can make a decision very quickly. So it's a great formula, I think.
All right. Well, I think we'll wrap up there. Thanks, John, for coming on. We'll probably bring you back on to talk more about Cisco in the future, if that's okay. And John, do you blog or tweet or anything like social that you want to tell people how to get in touch with you?
You know, I do have a blog at Cisco. If you look up Cisco, I think it's cisco.com/blog/service provider. Although I might have that link wrong, but if you Google Cisco SP and blogs, then you'll get to the right site. And I do blog there. And then I've been posting stuff on my LinkedIn account. Anybody wants to connect me on LinkedIn, just go ahead and send me something. Tell me that you heard about you listened to the Russ White podcast. Yeah. And then of course, you know, we've got lots of industry events. By the way, I mean, we're going online with our expo this year. We have an SCT expo in October, and normally it's a trade show where everybody shows up and looks at RF circuits and picks up things, and that's all going online. So it's going to be very interesting to see. Well, the industry does have a lot of white papers online. If you go to NCA, NCA technical white papers or some combination of that, you'll see a whole host of white papers that have been put together by a CTA and NCTA over the years, and myself and my team and all my friends and competitors have all our collective thoughts and words of wisdom in there.
Seems like it's NCTA paper, technicalpapers.com or something like that. But yeah.
Thank you. That is it. Yeah. It's a little unknown site, but it's a lot of interesting stuff there. It's really an archive of technology that goes, you'll find the early white papers there from back in the 90s on the analog lasers, and you'll find all the DOCSIS stuff there that we've been looking at. So, you know, between those white papers and the DOCSIS specs at Cable Labs, you've got the entire story of technology there.
You're just me, not you, Sharp, on Twitter, and that's it. I'm Russ White. You can always find me at rule11.tech on LinkedIn and who knows where else. Just don't PM me on Twitter. I say this every time and people still do it. And I don't know why people PM me on Twitter, because I don't answer PMs on Twitter. But anyway, cool. Thanks a lot for coming on, John.
It's my pleasure. Good luck with all your work that you're doing. I think this is a really important thing to capture the history of the internet. I'm glad somebody's sitting down and doing it. So I'd encourage everybody that's listening to go dig out your other podcasts and look up everything else that's going on. There's gems in there that I don't think are going to be captured really anywhere else. It's the internet's been a community gathering since its beginning, and it's strengthening it is based upon the people involved. So I think your contributions to this is welcomed and appreciated by everyone.
Thank you very much. And all right, we'll catch you next time on the History of Networking.
Subscribe to the History of Networking on your favorite podcast service or follow along at rule11.tech.